All right, so as we move into our continued exploration of the Four Noble Truths, we're in 8 months of it so far, starting off. So this is the Eightfold Path, and particularly the Wise Action. So just to kind of step back, I like to do at the beginning of each of these months to kind of see how things work together. So Four Noble Truths are really the defining way that the Buddha described the Dharma, the way of practice. Understanding the nature of dukkha or of suffering, what causes that to arise, what's the cessation of that, and then the path leading to the cessation. And so we're in the middle of that fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. Now it's interesting that the Buddha arranged it the way he did, because the Eightfold Path, we often think of meditation and maybe it gets our minds calmer, maybe we have these deeper realizations, maybe even enlightenment. But the Buddha said that's not enough. You also have to have, how do you live in the world? How do you actually show up? And how do you use your voice? How do you use communication, the wise speech? How do you use your actions of your body, the wise actions, which we'll unpack tonight? And then wise livelihood, which is the last one of these three sections, these three middle sections. And what's different, so you can think of these three middle parts as really around the ethical conduct, or how do we act in a way that's not causing harm toward other people? And how is that different from the five precepts that we often talk about? Essentially, they're not different. But we can see really in a clear way how these three aspects of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood are really sandwiched behind wisdom, between wisdom and also our meditative practice. That we use wisdom, our understanding, our right understanding, our right intention to understand what causes suffering in ourselves and others. That ideally forms into an intention, which then flows into our actions. And then we have the benefit of our meditative practice to allow us to start to see more clearly when we cause harm to ourselves, to be able to listen more deeply without reactivity, without defensiveness to our own impact of our actions on other people. So in this way, we see that's really an integrated way, that we can't just retreat into these sublime meditative states or these deep insights. We also have to take it into our lives, into the way we relate to others, how we live, how we communicate, how we act. So the first two factors of wise view and wise intention really articulate and define our understanding, our sense of wisdom, and then that flows into our action. So this middle section of the Eightfold Path gives expression to that wisdom. And this also has the effect of starting to calm down our minds, calm down our hearts. We start to live in a way that's based in not harm. There's an ease that starts to come from. There's a quality of joy that comes from that. So we can start to relax within ourselves. That quality of relaxing within ourselves allows a deeper quality of concentration to arise, which then allows a deeper quality of wisdom. It also helps us to just brighten our mind a little bit, to reflect on the good that we did today, you know, how we made choices based on non-harm, maybe in honesty, and having a sense of integrity. All these can help us brighten our minds so we have more energy for practice. I remember Joseph Goldstein telling a story that he was in a retreat and having some just kind of being really down and hard on himself. And his teacher wanted him to brighten his mind, to actually bring more energy. She said, okay, go to your room and reflect on your ethical conduct. All right, so what the teacher wanted him to do was reflect on all the good things he's done in his life. Right, but instead, of course, he reflected on all the things, all the little slights and all the ways maybe he stole some candy or something, and he actually became more and more depressed from that until he realized what the teacher is asking. So as we talk about this wise action, we often think of it externally, but I think it's also equally important to look at it internally. how we relate to ourselves. How do we relate to ourselves from a sense of honesty, of truthfulness? How do we relate to ourselves from a place of kindness, a non-harm? And sometimes we look at these precepts kind of as this passive barrier, passive gate that I'm not going to cross, and that can be helpful. But I think it's also helpful to have a more proactive relationship to them, to actually lean into them, especially in our areas that we have a little trouble around, that we have, you know, maybe trouble around always speaking what's true. So then we can become this force in the world based in non-harm and generosity, sense of integrity. Now there's classically three areas around wise action that we can explore. Non-killing, non-stealing, and non-sexual misconduct. So these three aspects are really the core of this wise action. Of course, we also have wise speech as a whole one in itself that we covered last month, and then we go into wise livelihood next month. Now, non-killing is kind of a fundamental one that we start to develop a sensitivity toward. Now, killing of things, of creatures, especially intentionally, I think for most of us, you know, that's a value that we have. And yet, how often do we have some critters or some creatures we say, okay, it's okay to just kill that one, just to get rid of the rat or the pest or the mosquito. And this precept, from the precept perspective and also from their wise view, it's the intentionality that really matters, how much intentionality we put into it. So if I'm just kind of walking and I accidentally step on a earthworm or a bug, you know, there's not much intention behind it. But if I really focus on it, that brings more of an issue with that. Now, all these, this one in particular, there's a lot of kind of gray areas around it. Because if we took it to an extreme, you know, we wouldn't want to brush our teeth, right? Because we're killing bacteria. If we got an infection, we want to take antibiotics. You know, so there's this sense of trying to bring a quality of practicing with. My favorite story I like to tell around this, you know, I use in the intro class, is early on in my practice, I really wanted to take on the precepts. And this one of non-killing, I was trying to hold as clearly as I could. And my daughter was about 3 or 4 at that age, and you know, sometimes she would have playmates over. I noticed this very massive wasp nest in one of our trees. And I wanted to protect the kids. I didn't want the kids to get stung. But I also didn't want to kill these wasps. So I decided to discourage them from going there. So I knocked down the nest and ran away really quickly. Right? And luckily, you know, the wasps didn't know where I was in time, so it was okay. But they really liked that spot. And they built the wasp nest again, almost in the exact same spot. And it's about like a basketball shape. I was really surprised. So being kind of a little overzealous, I decided to relocate them. So I put a garbage can underneath the nest, knocked it down, covered it up somehow without getting stung, and did a little catch and release into a remote part of a park. And they came back again. So then the third time that I got the can of Raid, but it was a very different relationship. I could really feel the sorrow of taking their lives, that they're just trying to make their way in the world. So in the same way, we can practice with this non-killing, that sometimes if we have termites or pests, you know, we have to make these hard choices, but see if there's alternatives. Now, non-stealing is the next aspect. So non-stealing, it's one of those ones that we can also really stretch into the nuances and the subtlety around it. Of course, there's the obviousness. Okay, if we see something and it's not ours, we take it. There's this obvious quality of stealing or breaking into someone's house or something like that. But what if we found like a $20 bill out in the parking lot? You know, will we say, okay, whose does this belong to? You know, will we be willing to bring it back, or will we, okay, well, I'll just pocket it? Or maybe you go to the grocery store and they have one of those sample table set up, and you have some really tasty sample, and you make maybe two or three passes by, just try to just. I'm not quite sure yet if I want it or not. It's not really the intention that they have for that. So you can start to see, okay, maybe I'm kind of going into that a little bit. Remember my very first meditation retreat when I was first exposed to the five precepts, and I listened to them. There was a sense of relaxing that I hadn't experienced before. That I didn't have to feel that sense of protectiveness around my wallet or my possessions. This was pre-cell phone time, so I didn't have to worry about that. But there's kind of that relaxing that I could trust that my fellow practitioners were holding these precepts. And this is one of the beautiful parts of each of these aspects is that when we start to take them on, it starts to transform our inner landscape. The people start to sense something different about us. We start to relax that tension around it, and they start to relax around us. So non-stealing often is referred to as taking that which is freely offered versus taking that which is not freely offered. So what is really freely offered? I think we all know people in our lives, or perhaps we're like that. It's really hard for us to say no. If we want to please people, we want to take care of people, and that willingness to say no, I'm going to draw a line and have a sense of boundary around this giving or this action. Sometimes it's hard to say no. So having that sense of discernment, is it really freely offered? Are they really wholehearted in that? Looking at things like time and energy and resources. If we do a, sometimes I do group interviews in retreats or on day-longs. And there's only so much time. How much time does each person get? How much time is appropriate? To just kind of be aware of everyone around you. Maybe those who speak up really easily, giving space for those who don't, is one way to practice with that sense of not stealing that time. Or be another aspect of this is the generosity. How can I practice it with a sense of generosity in all the ways that come up? And finally, around this non-stealing, I think it's helpful, especially this day and age, to think about future generations. What are we taking from future generations through our consuming, through our disregard for climate change? All those things are going to have an impact for our children, our children's children, all the way through. And then the final aspect is that of non-sexual misconduct. Non-sexual misconduct. Now, if you look at the suttas, there's often a kind of a simple way of saying this, that basically if someone's in a relationship, that you respect that. You don't intrude upon that relationship. Or someone's, the phrase is often under protection, like someone is a minor, to respect that also. But again, we can go into more of the nuances around this one. And this can be a very powerful one. Because our society has a lot of distorted views around sexuality and the expression of that. There's a sense of often objectifying people, seeing people in a certain light instead of the wholeness of them. And where it's almost really embedded in the way we see each other. So learning to see through that conditioning, to actually see the person as a whole, and actually the whole person instead of just this narrow aspect. Around relationships and intimate relationships, having awareness around, consent, what's really true consent with your partner. Because consent is one of those things which can be, you have to look a little bit deeper than just whether they say yes or not, or if they don't say no. And I think that's not necessarily enough. One example is when there's a big power differential between people, like a student and a teacher, a therapist and a client, clergy and a parishioner, what is that it's called? Any of those, a boss and an employee, all those kind of differences of power, it makes it harder for the one with less power to really say no, to have true consent. And that differential often causes a lot of difficulty and issues in that expression. Someone who's experienced, trauma their abuse. Their boundaries are often very shaky, and it's harder to establish that. So bringing wisdom and discernment to our relationships. Because sexuality is a wonderful part of being human. It's a delight to be with someone that wants to be with you. And to just have this sense of awareness of, you know, can I be aware of my own impulses, my own intentionality, and having good communication. So these three, kind of the three aspects of wise action are, again, wise, non-killing, non-stealing, and non-sexual misconduct. So the question is, as practitioners often should be, is what do we do when those energies arise? What do we do when we have that impulse to push against one of these wise views, or these wise actions, I should say? Because some traditions or some groups say, okay, you need to just suppress that. Just don't pretend it's not there, right? But if you ever try that, it doesn't really work very long. It doesn't work, and it just kind of sometimes goes very sideways. So as Dharma practitioners, we have this great benefit of being mindful, to actually turn toward our experience. What's actually here right now? And when we feel that edge of pushing against one of these wise actions, we can start to look and see, where is there suffering in myself? What suffering am I trying to solve or fix? Right? Am I coming from a place of inadequacy, of lack? And so my greed is going forward. Is there a sense of hurt? I'm going out through harshness, through lashing out. And when you feel that sorts of core of pain, meet it with some compassion, meeting with some quality of understanding. Right? So open to that quality. This is really the basis of the homework that I offer to you to practice with. And so this sense of turning toward really loops us back into the first noble truth, opening that there is dukkha. Where is there dukkha in this moment? Building the capacity to open and be with. Now, wise action, we can think of it almost working in two ways or two directions. So one way is it being like this set of boundaries or like guide rails that we kind of keep our actions in a certain corridor. We start to bump up against one or another, we get that feedback, okay, kind of leading into that precept or leading into that wise action. And we find ourselves doing that, whether we've actually stepped across the line, like maybe I lashed out and just, you know, killed that bug without thinking about it, or maybe there's a sense of harshness coming out through my speech, or maybe there's a sense of taking something that's not mine, or some way of my sexuality being a little distorted. That's a time of practice. It's a time actually turning toward and opening to what's here. You know, what intention led to that? What view led to that? So remember the first two folds, view is this understanding of what causes suffering. It's understanding, it's basically how well do we understand reality? How well do we understand how things work? How well do we understand the four noble truths? From that perspective, that forms into our intention, which then leads into our action. Right? But of course, if we have an action that's maybe not so skillful, or that's going against this wise action, this right action, then we have a different quality of intention that's leading it, a different view that's coming from that. We often learn from our mistakes. We learn from when we cross that line, when we do something that causes some harm to ourselves and others. And hopefully as we practice and learn and pay attention to that, we start to cross those lines more and more subtly. Or maybe we start to cross them through our minds first before we actually act on it. We find our minds going one way. There's this movement toward harshness, this movement toward stealing, this movement toward some distortion of my sexuality. And yet we don't act. We see that and we don't act. We can even start to sense we're getting close to that way. And this is, again, part of being human. This is part of this, like in the meditation, I talked about acknowledging what's here, what's actually here. And that's one of the most powerful things you can do for yourself, is to develop this very friendly relationship to seeing this whole gestalt, this whole array of you as a human being. Because if you have this kind of shadowing, I don't want to see this part, I don't want to see this other aspect, I'm ashamed of this lust, I'm ashamed of this greed, that sets up this tension. But if instead I'm willing to see it, or see the expression of it, see the impulse, that gives me much more choice of whether I act from it, much more choice of whether I enhance it or follow it. So then we're able to start to pause and maybe make a course correction. Now, what motivates us not to cross that line, that line of these ethical behaviors or a wise action? Sometimes it's really thinking about the impact or the fear of what people will think of us. You know, it's like if someone I really valued knew about this action, would I feel ashamed about that? Sometimes that gives us this energy to not follow it. Sometimes it's not wanting to get in trouble. And as our practice starts to mature, or as we mature, you know, emotionally and grow up, basically, we start to understand the suffering that's caused by those actions. We start to have a sense of empathy for, well, if I act in this way, this other person hurts. This other person grieves. The other person is impacted by this unclarity of action, who has to deal with the consequences of my experience. And so this starts to bring a whole different level of energy of not crossing these lines, of trying to protect them. An even deeper level, as our practice, if you start to really integrate this Four Noble Truths and this Eightfold Path together, we can ultimately see that when we act in a way that's unkind, that's unskillful, that's acting from a place of killing, of stealing, of sexual misconduct, ultimately the harm is also equally toward ourselves. You know, the harm is toward ourselves. Because we start to see these are expressions of these three unwholesome roots of greed, of hatred, and delusion. You know, maybe it's more one, more another, maybe it's a mixture of all of them. And that's really what's causing our suffering. You see how acting from those reinforces our suffering. And when we act from those roots, we sign ourselves up for immediate or future suffering. And this is really wise view, is understanding the first noble truth of what is dukkha. What's the origin of dukkha, the second noble truth. So this is the first way I talked about that, the way these precepts or this wise action can work, is that there's this boundary that we bump up against. And we realize, oh, I'm bumped up, I crossed it, or I'm about to bump up it again. Let me pay attention. Let me look deeper. Let me turn toward that place of suffering in myself. Let me turn toward that lack in myself. Let me tend to where the actual hurt is, instead of trying to fill it in some way that's only causing more suffering. The other direction that these start to work is really coming from the outside in. That once we start to understand the impact of our actions on others, we understand the impact on ourselves, we start to want to really breathe into those. We want to fill into those. Actually, that's how we go into the world. It's more of a proactiveness around wise action. Of non-killing, non-stealing, having integrity around our sexual energy. So it starts to shift from being something that we think we need to do or should do to something that we want to do, or even more, something that we don't really have a choice not to do. It's said that when someone crosses that first threshold of the stages of awakening, when they first cross over into what's called stream entry, there's a way that they just can't break the precepts anymore. That they just can't cause harm in the same way. Because they've connected the impact in a very deep way. they've also really uprooted this nature of self. So that self is often, if you kind of really look down deeply in a really subtle way, the self's often really tied to that deep hurt, that deep lack that's driving everything. And if that self isn't there, there's not the same hunger, there's not the same greed or hatred or delusion that comes forth. Then we start to emanate these ways, these qualities of right action. It just starts to be the way we are in the world. I think we all know people in our lives who are like that, that we just feel that we can relax around them. There's a sense of trust that's naturally there. It's like, okay, I don't have to, I can relax, I can be who I am. I don't have to be so guarded around this person. And that sense of not being guarded allows you to be yourself. Allows you to let down those boundaries and those defenses to be fully here, fully present. Unfortunately, it's rarer than we would like it to be. So that's one thing we can aspire to, is to be that kind of person in our own lives. And the only way to do that is to know yourself very deeply, to be willing to know all aspects of yourself, not to shy away from things, but to bring them into the light, to be seen, to be understood. So it starts to become like it's not an option to do these unwise actions. There's just a cost that's intolerable. And so then starts to transform these into these more positive expressions of this wise action. Often it's phrased as this non-killing, non-stealing, non-sexual misconduct. We can start to move into this place of generosity, this quality of a generous spirit, of seeing how can I offer what I can offer in a free way, in an easy way, in a no strings attached way. How can non-killing start to change into that quality of nurturing life, of empowering life, of delighting in life? What about sexual harm, changing that into honoring and supporting each person's wholeness, each person's integrity? And so these qualities that it starts to transform from, again, the boundaries and the borders we're trying to avoid to this natural or this lovely expression of wholeness. So wise action is a reminder from the Buddhist path that how we act in the world does matter. It does make a difference. And the Buddha put that right in the center of the Eightfold Path. If we didn't keep track of that, we could have all these great insights, these great understandings, but it's not integrated. And as practitioners who have households, who have relationships and work and jobs, we have a very precious opportunity to practice these, to notice these, to open to these. See, how does these show up? How can I breathe in my wisdom into my actions, into the way I speak, the way I show up in the world? All right. Let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle. So in a moment, we'll have a chance for you to share your thoughts or offer any questions I might respond to. I want to just go over the homework real quick. So in the chat, I think I put it in the chat. I'll just throw that back in there. So the homework, as a reminder for everyone, is not graded. It's not pass, fail. It's an opportunity for you to take the abstractness of a talk and kind of breathe your understanding into it, actually practice it, to inquire around it, to actually see how does it show up. So this week's homework is to reflect on the three wise actions. So non-killing, non-stealing, and non-sexual harming. I was trying to get the parallel tense there. When we find ourselves pushing against wise action, turn toward the suffering that is driving that impulse. Right? So when you find yourself coming against one of them, and you can throw in wise speech if you want, That's if you want for practice there. You find yourself pushing against one of these precepts or the wise action, wise speech. Just notice that impulse. You may notice it after the fact, right? It's like, wow, I just clobbered that cockroach. We don't really have cockroaches here, do we? We do? Yeah. Not like New Mexico. In New Mexico, you turn the light on, you would see like 20 scatter. But anyway. So you have cockroaches, you have, you know, whatever you might just kill without thinking about it. After the fact, you can reflect, okay, what, I just discounted this creature's life. I just discounted their existence. You know, and bring a sense of awareness around that. Maybe it's around stealing. Maybe it's around speaking that which isn't true. Maybe it's around the way we're relating to ourselves or another person through our, you know, our sexuality that feels a little bit distorted. Use that as an opportunity to turn toward and notice the suffering that's driving that impulse. Okay, noticing the suffering underneath that. Because often these precepts, when we push against them, these wise actions, there's an impulse of something inadequate, some suffering, some lack, some hurt that's driving it. I'm trying to solve it by lashing out, by getting something, by taking something. See if that source of that suffering can be met with compassion and understanding. And see if that doesn't open up the room for wise action to emerge. So see, this is a very different way of processing it than like, okay, I've got to keep myself in check. It's more noticing when I start to drift out, use that as a chance to know yourself more deeply, to learn yourself in a more complete way. That deeper learning, that willingness to see yourself in a full way is the best safeguard around ethics, around boundaries, around wise action. All right, so we have a chance now for any questions. And if you have a question in the room, we can bring a mic around for you so they can hear you online. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand. All right, up here in the front, Lucas.
I have a story. Might be a parable, I'm not sure.
Okay.
When we bought our house about 8 years ago, there was a patch of bamboo one corner of the house, and then there was this really large swath, almost the entire yard's worth of just wood chips that were turned out to be really deep. And what had happened was there was actually bamboo through our entire yard, and they had just chopped down the poles and then put bark over the top of it. But that doesn't stop bamboo at all. And so we found that there was about 1,600 square feet of bamboo on our property. And that's kind of problematic. And that really stressed us out. So we spent a lot of time. And I finally, trying to figure this out, somebody quoted it's like $80,000 to get rid of it. And I got this giant stump grinder. And I went through our entire yard, except for the patch that was still doing okay, that was standing. And I ground out the whole yard. It took me 2 days of like, you know, 15 hours of work to get rid of it. And that did it. And I put a big trench around the one that was there, and we put a thing in the ground. And I really didn't like the bamboo. Mm-hmm. I just felt really antagonistic towards it. But the patch that was there, over time, like, I kind of got a little office situated near it and started liking to stare out at it. And after a while, I kind of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years in, I started to really enjoy the bamboo. Mm. And this spring, it died. Mm. Just died. And it turns out bamboo lives about 50 years and then it goes to seed. Mm. And I had to take out those roots again, and this time I just felt really sad. Mm. And I had to like look at those things, and I had a totally different experience of it the second time around. And I just, you know, my kids were crying about it, and I was sad about it. Mm. So it's my parable or story. Not sure. But full circle.
Yeah, thank you, Lucas. That's a powerful story of the same exact action can be completely transformed by a relationship to it. You know, and how we grew to, you grew to appreciate and love the bamboo, and when it's time to get rid of the last bit, it was very different from that. I hate this stuff. I want to get rid of it. And that's one of the things with our practice. I think we can reflect, you know, whether it's something like time or just, you know, growing to love something, or just the way we are, kind of our habits of relating to other people or to family members or situations of our own lives or our bodies or things like that, that practice starts to transform it to one of connection versus aversion. It starts to transform that intention of interconnection versus separation. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that. All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything? Yes, thank you.
You mentioned a term I've never heard, stream entry. Could you explain that?
Yeah, kind of slipped that one in. Well, so if you look at the eight or the four noble truths, you know, there is first noble truth is that of dukkha. Second noble truth is the cessation of dukkha. Third noble truth is the cessation of that dukkha. Sorry, second I said was the origin of dukkha. Third is the cessation, the falling away of that. So nibbana is often a way it's translated, or nirvana if you want to use the Sanskrit. And often means just literally the blowing out. And one way that basically we could say it's awakening or enlightenment. So the Buddha's, you know, his whole message was this potential for awakening in all of us. And he, you know, laid out different maps and pathways and ways to understand it. And one of them was defining the different stages of awakening, different stages of enlightenment. So stream entry is the first one. There's four of them. But it's probably the most significant one, because once we've had that shift, and you can think of it as really as it's less of something that we attain or gain. It's not like we get our PhD or something. It's really letting go of distortion, letting go of things, seeing things in an unclear way. And one of the fundamental pieces of that is this belief in self, this belief in this sense of a constant, non-changing self. And it's often we look out in the world, you know, as we're talking, as listening, there's a sense of me who's experiencing everything, right? So what the Buddha pointed to is that me, that sense of me is actually conditioned. It arises and it passes away. There's actually this deeper quality of consciousness that transcends this kind of local, isolated sense of me. When we realize that, see it in a direct way, in an immediate way, for ourselves, there's a falling away of that sense of separation. And so that's one of the defining qualities of stream entry, the first stage of awakening. Does that help? Yeah. You're welcome. Sotapanna, I believe, is the Pali for that. Yeah, Charles.
Hi. Thank you for the talk, Tim. I was wondering, when we talk about right action, what determines if an action is right or wrong is the outcome, right? Whether the outcome is conducive to happiness or whether it leads to suffering.
Yes and no. I mean, the outcome is a big part of it, but a lot of the outcomes we can't control. But the intention, we do have some control over. Right? So it's my intentionality. I would put more emphasis on my intention versus the outcome. I mean, we need to listen to the outcome. We need to listen to the impact of our actions. But it's the intentionality which is really the key piece. Right? Because I could do something that it feels my intention is really clear, my wisdom is really clear, and it could just, you know, people may not respond very well to that. Right? So I might look at the timing of it. Maybe it was the wrong message, or maybe it's just that's people's reaction. So it's a little harder to rely on the outcome versus the intention.
Could I just ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
I just feel like there's been a lot of times in my life where my intention wasn't bad, but I caused a lot of harm.
Hmm. And that piece is interesting because our intention, sometimes you can look and see, okay, was my intention really as clear as it could be? You know, and sometimes we're often very confused as human beings, right? We kind of think, okay, this feels right. I'm going to say this, but then it kind of blows up and then maybe part of it we're not seeing. Can you give me a little bit of the specifics? So you don't have to go with the details, but just kind of the context of it around, you know, what general area. I don't want to put you on the spot, but.
Well, like, for example, just recently, I'm from a Catholic family, so I thought it was a good idea for me to, and I sang a lot of my life, so I thought it was a good idea for me to join the church choir.
Okay.
And I did this during the summer, and what I learned when I showed up to the Mass is that there's just not that many people in the church choir during the summer. So I was one of three singers, and I hadn't practiced using the right book, and I didn't really know the order of Mass really well, and so I went through the Mass, and it was kind of catastrophic.
Mm.
It just I didn't sing well, and you know, it was harmful to, I felt like it was disrespectful to the people in the Mass. Mm. I felt like it was harmful to my reputation.
Mm.
I felt like it was a harmful thing. It was not a good thing. But my intentions were completely right.
Yeah.
So As someone, trying to do the right thing, I feel like often the best way to go about it is to try to think of the outcome of whatever happens.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I always hear about the importance isn't to think of the future. The important thing is to be in the present moment and to be mindful. So I'm just not sure, you know, how would an arahant go about making decisions? Would he be mindful in the present moment and that's how he would inform his decision, or would he look in the future and try to understand the outcome?
I think both. Yeah, I think part of what you can think of intentionality is kind of that impulse to act. But then to actually act, we sometimes have to get things, we have to get skills, we have to figure out the landscape so the action is really, you know, helpful or beneficial. So if you had someone who was a realized being, you know, they would probably look at the organization, you know, with the situation, the players, because you can say, just do it this way. That, you know, maybe the organization has to kind of adjust or have time to get together. Like, let's say you and I said, okay, let's go climb Mount Rainier. Okay, I think that'd be a great thing to do. Our intention feels good, but if we just got in the car and drove there, it wouldn't be a very successful trip, right? Because we'll get lost, we want all our equipment. So it's like, okay, this is my intention, so I start to get prepared for it. So part of it is that discernment. So think of intentionality as that impulse to act, but then how you act, you have to kind of see, okay, am I prepared to act in a skillful way? Maybe there's things they have to build around it. So I wouldn't necessarily, so it kind of gets kind of, sometimes we try to fit everything into this little narrow Buddhist teaching stuff, you know, but it's intentionality to action you know, it also has all these other aspects like wise view, you know, wise understanding, wise effort, and all these other pieces that help make it happen. And, you know, maybe it's, you never know that. It's also hard to know sometimes the outcome of things. Like there may be an initial thing, but maybe from that experience, people learn some lessons about, okay, maybe we need to, you know, put this kind of scaffolding in so people can succeed in the choir. Yeah, so let's see. You know, I've made lots of things which felt like mistakes that it turned out to be very beneficial. You know, sometimes it's by learning from my mistakes. Sometimes it's by failing is what I learn most from. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Anyone else have anything they'd like to ask or share? Yes. And online, remember, just raise your virtual hand.
Thank you. I was on retreat many years ago, and there was a Buddhist nun from Canada there, and she was incredible. But she was talking about in their community, they're digging in the soil with spoons, and she said at the end of the day, they have to reveal to their community what they might, what precept they might have broken that day. And even if it's unintentional, so she was explaining that one day she had to tell the community that she accidentally killed an earthworm. And I remember going, this is really strange. First of all, that they're digging in the soil with spoons, but also that this idea that you have to tell someone. So I want to tell a story just briefly about what I did before I came tonight, which was I was hurrying around and I was at the sink. And there was a little tiny bug. And I want to confess to you, I just went. It was just, it was so instinctive. And the moment it happened, I was like, oh. Then this week, I'm working with an Airbnb and I had to go in. And there were all these cookies and cakes and candies. And my first impulse was to, I'll just take one. Maybe two. And it's so interesting to watch that come up and then to have practiced long enough that I was, oh, there I am. I'm being greedy. And not a feeling of shame, but, oh, there it is again.
Yeah, good.
So I just want, I want to share about the bug. I'm confessing as they do in their community.
Yes, the monastics, you know, monks and nuns, they have this, I don't know if it's once a week or once a month, they get together and they, you know, they share, you know, basically their transgressions or their ways they kind of broke the precepts. And I think when it's done well, it's really seen as a chance of learning. It's like, oh wow, this is kind of just like you did. I saw this impulse, I wasn't paying attention, or I've got carried over with my greed or whatever it is. But it's a chance of really strengthening through community. If it's not done well, it can go into shame. You know, it goes into that sense of guilt. And that's kind of that edge, you know, of how do we hold it. You know, I was noticing, I think it was just today, I was in the bathroom and there was a mosquito and I was like, okay, I'm doing this talk, but I'm going to kill it anyway. Because it's, you know, it's in my house, you know, that kind of a thing. But at the same time, I was also out hiking and, you know, there was these bugs. I was like, okay, this is their home. You know, how can I maybe put on bug spray so they don't bother me, but not, you know, trying to be more mindful of that. So it's like, it's this, all these gray areas of how do you practice with it. And the precepts, remember, they are framed not as thou shall not. It's, I undertake the training to refrain from, which is a really different way of framing these, to understand that we will fall down. You know, my wife and I, when we were getting, about to get married, my teacher, Rodney Smith, was going to marry us, and we worked on our vows, and we were like, you know, kind of gung-ho, and he said, how about you build some, you know, humanness into them that we'll endeavor to versus we will always. You know, and that's, it gives us some space to be human. Yeah, because I think as a society, we're pretty good at guilt and shame. And I don't know how helpful it is. I think it really becomes something which is really distorts the way we practice, the way we view ourselves, the way we see ourselves. It's one of the fundamental, talking about stream entry, it's one of the fundamental blocks that we use to keep that sense of self intact. Because when you're feeling ashamed about something, when you're feeling guilty about something, you really know who and what you are. You know, that the whole logic is there. But if you have that quality of like Carol Wilson, I remember being on a retreat when she was teaching, and someone brought her like this little nest they have found with these little eggs in it, or maybe showed her the nest. And Carol admitted she had this impulse, I could just smash them right now. I mean, she didn't do that, but she was just kind of laughing about that impulse and how that just arose. She wasn't going to do that, but that's that lightness. You see this impulse arise, and there's no energy to follow it, but there's no energy to repress it either. Repress the rising of the thought. And that's one of the benefits of, the discussion nights that we'll have like next week, is you have a chance to talk about how are you working with this? You know, how are you working in the nitty gritty of your life? All right. Anyone else? Anyone online like to ask anything? All right. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Tim. Can you talk about the relationship between right action and sila?
Sure.
Is it like a subset of sila?
Yeah, it's a good question. Sila, you know, is often translated as ethics. And so I think sila is kind of the big umbrella term of it, you know, of ethical behavior, ethical actions. And certainly the precepts, the five precepts are a part of sila. But you can also see the Eightfold Path, this middle section is of sila, because it's all around, you know, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And the way those are defined is basically the precepts, basically. So it's basically synonymous. I think the wise action piece brings in this kind of implied relationship with our wisdom. You know, that you're ethical, not just because you want to be a good person, but because it's your wisdom which is expressing that. It's your wisdom and understanding which make you want to be kind, want to be based in non-harm. Yeah, so that's implicit also in the precepts. It just more clearly stated, really is really laid out there in the Eightfold Path. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Could you enlarge a little bit too on the stream entry? When you were first talking about it, you said something about it. It sort of happens to you more than you happen to it. It's you find yourself behaving differently. Is that what you were implying?
Well, I was trying to point to it, not because sometimes we hear stream entry and it becomes a goal, becomes something we want to get to. And it's true that it's helpful to have that as an aspiration. It's helpful to have it be something that we're kind of aiming our practice to. But at the same time, our sense of will or sense of effort of me trying to accomplish something, me trying to make myself a more shiny, polished version of myself pushes that actually away. It's like the cat or the dog trying to chase its tail, because it's already there. It just like it starts to go further away. So that's what I was trying to point toward. It's not something that we can make happen, but we can kind of incline ourselves to that. One teacher, I forget who said this, that awakening is an accident. You know, it happens by accident. It just arises. But we practice to make ourselves more accident prone, right? So, and it's true, like our practice, if you look at our practice, even something as simple as how do you do meditation, mindfulness practice, embedded in it is already tools or ways that start to loosen this conviction of self. You know, it starts to soften that landscape. Because, you know, we sit, we meet this breath, we meet this sound without adding anything to it, without changing it. We're just trying to observe it. That's trying to bring forth this quality of presence, of awareness, which is really, let's say it's really the essence of what we are, is that. And yet we carve a part of that out and say, I'm the meditator. I'm doing a good job meditating. I'm doing a bad job meditating. But yet the practice itself starts to loosen those footholds. And for a lot of people, it takes a certain amount of intentionality to get close to that. Maybe it's through retreats, maybe it's through inquiry, maybe it's through questioning the premise of self. But it's another teacher talked about it, like I said, you can get to the door and knock, but then you can't make the door open. The door has to open of its own accord. There's a letting go that happens. And it's often a strong shift of perspective, of orientation, that you suddenly, the sense of me who's always been here is no longer so localized. It's like there's this much bigger sense of awareness that replaces it.
Thanks, Tim.
You bet, Bob. All right, anyone else? Yes.
Yeah, Gus, I've been thinking about these things in the past, like non-killing, like non-harming, and refraining from sexual misconduct, and then not stealing. And I think that I kind of felt like, you know, not trying to harm other living beings, kind of working with that, and like, you know, non-sexual harming, kind of trying to be aware of the way I'm thinking of other people. Uh-huh. And I had like a little bit of difficulty with non-stealing, like that, not that I steal from other people, but it just like felt less useful to me. Like, and I don't know, my mind kind of went to like, labor theft and big corporations. Sure. or stealing is like, and I kind of framed it in my mind a little bit. I liked the wording of to refrain from taking what's not freely given. Mm-hmm. When I kind of changed that rather than stealing. Yes. And I kind of, the things that came into my mind in situations was like, when you have that kind of tendency to like want to adjust your behavior to make other people like you or something, that in my mind I would say that kind of in a way, you're taking something that's not freely given. Mm-hmm. Right? You're trying to like, you know, to force their affections, or mm-hmm. If you have like, you know, I had some friends who I was kind of like pushing, I want to see you again, like let's spend time together, and like they were distant, and this came up in my mind then. I was like, well, don't take what's not freely offered. Mm-hmm. That if you don't want to if your energy or something is not freely mm-hmm. offered, then I'm not going to take it from you. I'm not going to force it from you. And I guess that's how kind of the way that I maybe made it a little more helpful to me.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I think it's when you hear the precepts, I think it's helpful to kind of notice which ones we kind of like, you know, oh, you know, I don't know about that one. And that's one that's worth kind of working with it. And sometimes the phrasing and the language has a lot of power to it. Like, don't steal, you know, it's like, okay, you know, versus, okay, freely offered. It's like there's a much more of a relational way of relating to that. And, you know, seeing like in terms of people's interactions and energy, you know, how can I tell if it's really freely offered? I mean, all these we have to find our own pathway into it, you know, and part of that pathway is kind of learning to see through our other distortions that come in. It's like, oh, I don't want to put myself out there. I don't want, you know, there's those pieces too. We can kind of go too far one way. So it's kind of a fine line. But at the same time, also notice when something is freely offered, how good it feels to receive it. Mm-hmm. You know, and really make contact with the person. It's like, oh, wow, you want to hang out? Let's go for a walk. Yeah, that sounds great. Really notice that and appreciate that. Because sometimes we focus so much on what we shouldn't do But if we start to bring that, how good it feels to do that, that brings a lot more energy to our practice and to our lives. It's like, wow, you know, here, do you like one? Yes, thank you. You know, and really appreciate that giving and, you know, honor the person who gave it to you. It could be very simple. I mean, we see that all the time, right? Oh, go ahead in line. Thank you. You know, really appreciate that. That moment of non-harm or that sense of integrity. And it's like, oh, you know, I like you. Oh, you don't feel that way? Okay. Well, then that's, you know, it's like all those, these subtle ways, but appreciate when it goes, when you are all following that.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice way of modeling how to work with that. All right. Anyone else like to ask, share anything? Oh, go ahead, Emery. Your hand is kind of hidden in your background there.
Yeah, it is. Hi. Thank you so much for all of the wisdom and the different points. One of the ways that I was thinking that I feel like I cause the most harm to both myself and to other people is hurrying, like moving very quickly through life and, maybe, you know, doing too much. And that led me to think that, you know, these three categories of non-killing, non-stealing, and non-sexual harm, they're so specific and they're so, they seem kind of circumscribed. And so I'm just wondering about the whole concept of non-harm in general as right action or wise action, and, you know, where something like that maybe, yeah, something like hurrying or overdoing or rushing, being too busy, like that might not fall into killing, stealing, or sexual harm, but it would certainly fall into not, you know, harming.
Yes.
So I just wondered what you had to say about that.
Sure. Yeah, what comes to mind around that is I often kind of do a shorthand for all the precepts and all this section of the Eightfold Path, of the Sila section, of non-harm. Because non-harm is kind of this umbrella way that, you know, I can get a handle on it. So I can kind of connect with that. It's easier to remember that. Because often I kind of touch into my heart and say, okay, am I coming from a place of non-harm? And how I speak, how I use my body, how I use my sexuality, how I use, you know, taking or not taking, that free, that give and take. And that sense of non-harm can also extend toward myself. So I think it's like part of it, like part of our task is to take this, is really this is 2,600-year-old languaging and framing, and how can we make it so it seems relevant and alive for ourselves? Like Justin talking about taking the non-stealing and transforming it in a way. So you could do the same thing. Okay, I'm going to just focus on non-harm. You know, how can I have a sense of non-harm through my actions? And hurrying is an interesting one, right? Because it's kind of like, you're not like intending to cause harm, but it's like this kind of, what do you call it? Aftermath of you whirling, you know, hurrying through. And I can certainly relate to that myself, is that sometimes the objective or getting things done becomes a higher priority than the relationships or my own health or my own, you know, sleep or well-being. So that sense of letting go and so trying to find what does it really mean to hurry? What does it mean to feel rushed, to kind of always try to get a lot of things done? You know, to not do that, maybe there's a sense of letting go. Maybe that starts to come to the foreground. So I'm just trying to point out that finding your own way through this is really a rich territory and interesting territory to practice. It's like, okay, the way maybe next week you can share how you reframed this whole thing around, you know, hurry. You know, and I remember Christina Feldman would often take a kind of an intention for the year. And 1 year she took the intention to not hurry. Okay, I'm just not going to hurry. And she just kind of actually liked that one so much she kept up with it. But she also noted that you can move fast and not be hurrying. Mm. You know, you can move quickly, but there's this internal quality of spaciousness and ease. And I think that often, that's a nice pointing that she gave indirectly around that, is that that internal sense of hurrying, it's like, I got to get to the next moment. Mm-hmm. You know, we could see in some way that's really denying this moment. There's a almost, you know, violence might be a little strong, but there's a little bit of that discounting or trying to annihilate, not really honoring how this moment actually is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me think too about how, like, the question, is this suffering or is this non-suffering, could be brought to any of these, you know, to any, any, you know, unwise action. If you checked in with yourself,
yes,
you would realize that at the root there is suffering happening within myself.
Yeah, beautiful. Exactly. Yeah, going back to Lucas's question around, I think it was your question. Was it your question? No, whose question was it? Someone's question about the Sila. It was Bob's question. Mm-hmm. Sila. Someone's question.
It was Bob.
It's our question, Bob's question. That basically, it's just what you said, is that Sila, when it's sandwiched inside the Eightfold Path, is really coming back to wise view, the understanding of what causes suffering, what causes the release of suffering. Yeah, so that's a good summation of the whole thing. And if it brings you alive and brings the practice to the forefront, then that's a good way to practice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, this is, we're kind of going into a little bit of wise effort, you know, how that can show up in our lives. It's because wise effort is, you know, what really engages us. And there's a discernment of what causes suffering, what causes the release of that suffering. And then how do we modernize it? How do we actually make it come alive for ourselves? Okay, go ahead, Gary.
I was thanking you for putting the context behind these three. And what Emery said reminded me of, for me, something that's close in proximity, and that's showing up late for meetings.
Hmm.
And that was a bad habit of mine for a while. And then I didn't think of it in terms of harming, but it is. It taking up people's time that they've given to you. And it's harming yourself too, because when you show up late for meetings, what else aren't you doing timely? And then I fixed that one, and then I started showing up too early. And when you show up too early, then your other meeting participants, at least if it's a one-on-one, sometimes they feel obligated to entertain you or make sure you're taken care of, and it kind of disrupts their flow too. So I just wanted to make that observation and tag on to what Emery was saying.
Thank you. Yeah, and that kind of goes back to what Charles was saying. It's just like noticing the impact of our actions. Like, okay, I'm late, it causes impact. I'm too early, it causes impact. I kind of find just that right spot there. And that's part of the dance of being human and being practitioners. We get to notice and change. And it's also situational, right? Like if we were in a different culture, showing up late is like, yeah, that's, you know, meeting's supposed to start at 1 and people start showing up at 2:30. You know, that's cool. That's how it is. Yeah. Other cultures is like, if you're a minute late, you're, you know, if you're 5 minutes early, you're late. You know, so it's, we just pay attention and learn and say, okay, what's here? And And that's one of the pieces, just to kind of wrap up. A couple of questions around non-self or on satipana, or not satipana, but stream entry, is that the less we are invested in any our sense of self, the more fluid we're able to be. We can adapt to situations because we're not trying to make life fit into this narrow construct. We can adapt. We're much more fluid, and that's part of the freedom that this practice is pointing toward.